I think the game tricks us into thinking that golf is more connected than it really is. I like to view the game now as a series of independent decisions and events. And the more I can prioritize that, the more I can feel comfortable that each shot is a separate decision and a separate circumstance that has technically nothing to do with what came before or what's going to come.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Excited to have you with us here today. We have a great discussion with our good friend, John Sherman. John Sherman, the author, the Plus Two Handicap, the golf performance coach. You might know him from such books as The Four Foundations of Golf, which I'm holding up right now for those of you who are watching us on YouTube. Just a reminder now that you can watch all our podcasts as well in the Golfers Journal channel on YouTube. Check that out. And you might also know John from our good friends at Chasing Scratch. Today, John's going to give us a lot of useful information designed to not only help us score better, but maybe more importantly, to enjoy golf more. Now, hopefully those two things go together, but even if we can't make the ball drop, John has some great insights on how to have more fun out there. And hey, isn't that the point? It's kind of, I guess. If you are part of the Index experiment, this is going to be right up your alley. And if you're not, what are you waiting for? Jump in. Go to your member locker. It's easy to get signed up. Again, it's our community effort to reach our goals this year in golf or otherwise. My goals this year are handicap reduction, also a little Tom Coyne reduction. I'm trying to lose some weight, and I'm doing better in that than I am with the golf right now. I think that's why Casey's letting me record these intros on camera now, because, it's a sign that things are pointing in the right direction, I suppose. We remind you to update your progress once you've set your goals. And then once you've done that, we enter you to win free stuff. So we're basically giving you free stuff to get better. Pretty good deal. Free stuff like maybe the all new Pro V1 or Pro V1 X, which of course are the most advanced versions yet. They will help reward your best swings like never before. Both models are longer, more consistent, and feature unrivaled controls. So find out more about the new Pro V1 and Pro V1X and find out which is the right one for you at Titleist.com. Very excited to share that today's questions for John came from you. They came from Index Experiment participants in the Broken Tee Society, which is of course, our Discord platform, our clubhouse in the clouds. Again, easily accessible through your member locker. So thanks to everyone who submitted questions. John does a fantastic job with them, as you're about to hear. But just one more quick reminder, the lottery for our Lancaster event opens February 28th. So get in on that. 36 holes on this insane piece of Pennsylvania property. I can't wait. I'm going to be there. I hope to see you there as well. So now let's turn things over to John and your questions. I think, you know, he handles them really, really well. I think no matter if you actually get better from listening to this, you're going to feel like you're better. And then doesn't that actually mean you are better? We'll let John get into all that.
John, thanks so much for joining us today. Thrilled to have you back.
Thank you, Tom. Looking forward to our chat. It's good to see you again.
Okay, thank you. Good to see you. Looking forward to digging in on some stuff. You were kind enough to come into one of our Broken Tee Society discussions on the Discord server, which was wonderful. But given that we are undertaking the Index experiment at the Golfers Journal, we thought we got to get John back on. We have more to talk about. And I think what's great, where I wanted to start, is who you are and what you do and how you got into doing it. Because if anyone's listening to this and they're thinking, oh, they brought on a swing coach and none of this is going to apply to me, that's not the case. You're not PGA. We probably won't hear any specific swing tips here today. Rather, you're interested in building a game that people can enjoy. How did you get there? And what do you describe your title? What is your title? How do you describe what you do?
I think the best way to describe myself is a player coach. long story short, I kind of looked around at the golf instruction improvement landscape sometime in 2014. As someone who played for a long time and gotten pretty good, I said, you know, there's enough about the golf swing out there. We've got that covered. And I feel that other topics that are equally important are not being covered. So I just bought a website domain called Practical Golf in 2015. And I started writing articles on those topics. I don't think they were very good at first, but I started hashing out my ideas. And over the years, I settled on four topics, which I felt were really helping golfers and I had some expertise in. And that ultimately became my book, The Four Foundations of Golf. So those topics are expectation management, strategy, also referred to as course management, how to practice effectively, and what I would call my version of the mental game. So no, I'm not doling out swing tips. I think we've got enough of those. I think some of the methods I talk about can improve your swing without consciously trying to change it from a technical standpoint. But I'm here to help golfers manage their games and more importantly, forge a better relationship with golf, because I struggled with that for a really long time. And I know a lot of other people do, because this game is difficult and challenging, as we all know.
Yeah, that's well put. The one's relationship with golf. I've certainly had my ups and downs as well. And yet we come back to it. And here is the book, of course. You'll see, John, my copy is dog-eared and
yeah,
and
it's
aged
it's,
through.
It's very long. Maybe we'll talk about 3% of it today.
There's a lot in there, but yes, the four foundations of golf that you just described. But that relationship with golf, why do we keep coming back to it? How did you find your way back to it? Was there a low point where you just said, I've got to find a different way?
Yeah, well, you're leading me into my my embarrassing story that I did put earlier in the book.
That's
but
what
yeah,
I tried to do.
I was someone who became obsessed with the game as a, you know, 11, 12 year old who played a lot of other sports and just, you know, loved the game. And then somewhere around in my 20s, I kind of lost my way. I describe it as my expectations and skill level were completely misaligned. And I think that's where a lot of us get into trouble in this game. And that moment you talk about, excuse me, is, I had a really bad outburst of anger on the course with my dad, where I broke a club and he just walked off the course in disgust without saying anything. And this was in my early 20s. And I just realized, hey, you can't go on this way. You have to do something different. And at that point, it was just, hey, I can't play and practice a lot. I just want to enjoy the time I have out there. And when I do get into a situation where that can change, then of course I can adjust my expectations to the amount of time I can put into the game. And I think I call this my happiness equation. And it's different really for every golfer, because, you know, I know some people come to me and saying, I can only play once a month or, you know, once every other month. And I tell them, well, that's not enough time on the course to expect any kind of breakthrough. I would tell you, just enjoy it, have fun. Don't even keep score sometimes. But if you, on the flip side, if you are someone who has time to devote to this game and you are willing to prepare, then we can change what we expect from the game. But I think that's the hardest thing to manage, is how much you're putting in and what you expect to get out, because this game tricks you into thinking that you're going to get a lot more out of it than you put into it. And it just doesn't always work that way. And it can be incredibly frustrating.
It is the game's great three card Monty, right? That it is, we probably believe we're better than we are, because there have been moments where we were.
Yes.
So infrequent as they are, as David Owen likes to say, I wish just once I would play my usual game. So it keeps us coming back. I love that story about, I mean, it's a embarrassing story, I understand, about the breaking of the club. But because I experienced the same thing in reverse, where I was caddying for my dad and he wrapped a 5-iron around a tree. And, you know, bent it at a nice, you know, 45 degree angle, and then just handed it back to me as if I was supposed to, like,
put that back in the bag.
It doesn't fit anymore, man. What do you want me to do with this? But he talks about that and he says, man, I said, I'll never do that again. There are those wake up calls where you say,
yeah, we all have our rock bottoms in this game, hopefully. And then if you have some type of revelation or reflection upon it, perhaps the things are going to get better from there.
Yeah, and I like how that it focused you on this idea of we are out here to have fun. Now, fun is a different, as you said, is different for different people. Fun for me, and probably fun for you, and a lot of people listening, is it's a lot more fun if I'm making decent numbers. So it's great that, you know, and this book is designed, and your approach is designed to help us do that. Now, we curated a number of questions for you here today from our a collection from our folks in the Broken Tea Society, which is, of course, our Discord server, our clubhouse in the cloud. They were very excited to hear that we'd be speaking with you. And we got a lot of great questions from our listeners. So I want to run through some of these. And then, of course, I have a couple of my own. But I'll start off here, John, from this is from one John Law. He says, I'd love to give John some tips. I'd love John to give some tips on the mental side of the game. Like, how do you get a rubbish shot out of your head when you're hitting the next shot? So I'm guessing John's coming to us from the British Isles, perhaps, asking about rubbish shots and how to get them out of one's head. What would you say about those shots and moving on to the next shot?
I think there's a few ways to answer the question. First off, I always want to manage expectations. You can't solve this problem completely ever. I don't think any golfer on the planet has the ability to remain perfectly present on each shot. I always say golf is it's like a battle between the past and the future. You're worried in this instance about a shot you already hit, and is it going to affect the next one? Are you going to be angry about it? And then sometimes we worry about the future. If you're playing well, you're, oh, am I going to shoot my best round? I've got four holes to go. Or if you're playing terribly, you're like, how bad is this going to get? So I think the hardest question to answer in the game is remaining present. So I wouldn't expect to ever solve this completely, but you can get incrementally better. So I would say there's two main ways to answer this question. The first would be, I think the game tricks us into thinking that golf is more connected than it really is. I like to view the game now as a series of independent decisions and events. And the more I can prioritize that, the more I can feel comfortable that each shot is a separate decision and a separate circumstance that has technically nothing to do with what came before or what's going to come. Mm-hmm. So for example, the best scenario I always bring up that we struggle with is you hit that bad shot into the trees. And what usually happens is this gambler's mentality kind of comes into play, or tilt, as we refer to it in poker, is that you're so angry about your initial mistake that you can't get it out of your head. And now you're looking for that opening in the trees and say, what can I do to make par here still and make up for that bad tee shot? And unfortunately, what that does is it pours gasoline on the fire. And that's where the doubles and triples and quads come from, which really is what separates the great golfers from the not so great golfers. So I think it's more of a commitment to believing that this game is separate decisions. And on each one, you have to do your best to, and this is very hard, to put the last shot out of your mind and saying, okay, what happened before is irrelevant. I have a decision to make here now. And whether it's, you know, missing a putt for par on the last hole and going on to the tee saying, this is a new situation. So I think that's a philosophy. I think that if people adopt that, it can help them. The second way I would answer that is through having routine. I know this is very cliched and overused in golf, but I really do believe in it, is having some type of mental cocoon that you can go into before each shot that feels so automatic and so comfortable, and that you can repeat on the practice range or on the golf course, that it just kind of turns off a lot of things in your head and you're just going through this routine. I got a chance to play golf with a great NFL kicker once. And I asked him, like, how did you deal with kicking in the Super Bowl in front of all those people at the last moment? And he's like, I just did the same thing over and over and over again in practice, down to the millisecond. I would do it on the sideline during games. And when it came time, they called my number. I didn't have time to think about it. It just kind of happened. Again, easier said than done. But I think if you can hang your hat on that golf truly is an independent series of decisions, and that if you can create some type of system or routine before each shot that allows you to pick a target intelligently, allows you to go through some type of physical rehearsal and execution and pull the trigger, that can help alleviate a lot of these problems, but it's not going to solve it completely. And of course, people have written entire books on this question. So that's just two brief answers I could give to that.
Two very good answers and refreshing as well. I like the idea, you know, saying that it's okay. We're not probably, you know, being after, you hear so much about the one-shot mindset,
yeah,
and staying in the moment and staying present. And you can try to do that for a very long time and find yourself not able to accomplish, you know, you're not going to levitate to sort of nirvana. That's not right. That's not the point. But I like this idea of, if I can just get a little bit better, then I have a better chance. Human nature is not going to allow us to suddenly be enlightened golfers.
Yeah. I don't want to tell anyone that this, I think the hardest thing we do is when we embark on any new behavior or habit in golf, it becomes this all or nothing proposition. I can tell you, as the one giving you this advice, I fail at this during tournaments and many other times where I sometimes I'm still pissed off about the putt I missed or the tee shot I hit, but I do it far less than I did 10 years ago. And that's why I'm a better player and a happier player. So yeah, it's never an all or nothing proposition.
Better player, happier player, progress, not perfection. And as you mentioned, I think we should say, tell people you are a good player. What is your handicap right now?
Right now I'm a +2,
which is really good.
I know you play at a high level too, Tom. I know you've worked hard on your game, but yeah, it's, I try and be honest about my playing record.
No, I do too. I think you got
to
put it out.
If you're going to listen to me, if you're going to listen to me as a player coach, you have to understand that, like, I'm putting my game under fire. I play a ton of tournaments every year, and I want to make sure I test out a lot of the things I'm thinking about and noticing in others' games. I never thought I would play at this level, but it just kind of happened slowly over a period of years. And for anyone who wants to improve their handicap, I think that's an important message, is that, like, there wasn't this like one moment or breakthrough that happened. It's just kind of this like long slog where it's like you have some breakthroughs and setbacks. And that's another important thing to understand about handicap reduction, is like, it's just not this like overnight thing. It's this kind of long, fun journey, I think.
It should be fun. And again, incremental improvements. Absolutely.
Sure.
And I like that. No, I agree. I think if you play, you post. So sharing, you know, what your handicap is or where your game is, I think is important. You'd be giving me shots. I'm happy to say 4 shots. I'm a 2 right now. And I like the USGA just on the Gin app just came up with this sort of year in review little graphic where they, you know, how many courses did you play? What was your lowest handicap? Blah, blah, blah. And you see people posting that. I think it's My Gin Experience or something on.
I partook in that in Twitter. I thought it was pretty fun.
I think it's pretty cool. I think it's, you know, yeah. Hey, I think we should be, for me, it makes me feel like accountable and makes me want to work a little harder. Like if I'm just going to, I can just pump in bogus scores to get my handicap down, or I can give myself a lot more putts, or I can think, you know, well, that one, you know, that it was a breakfast ball, you know, like there's certainly ways to reduce your handicap, but you know, hey, here's my number. Here's what it is. I'm trying to get better. And, you know, and wherever you are, like you said, incremental improvements. I like that you're talking about, you talked about targets in there, because we have a question from Will Terry. He's curious if there's a point where you start getting more aggressive with your targeting, not chasing tuck pins, but more, okay, this pin's sitting, sitting duck, let's knock it down. Because I think we should preface that by saying, you talk about picking the right targets quite a bit in your book.
Mm-hmm.
What would your approach to targets be, and when do you get more aggressive?
Generically speaking, I think with approach play and even wedge play, the answer is to be more conservative than most golfers assume. I think most golfers have strategy backwards. They're too conservative off the tee and then too aggressive with iron shots. And I think that script should be flipped for a number of reasons. Again, I won't get into that because I'll be talking for 2 hours. So to answer Will's question, who I did play with at the Chasing Scratch event that you were at, Tom.
Hey.
Will's a great guy. We had a really good time. I think it depends on the skill level of the player. I think the better you are and the more skilled ball striker, the more quote unquote aggressive you can get with your targets. And more importantly, the closer you get to the hole. So I would never chase, if we're thinking about a green in like 4 quadrants, for example, and let's say I had a 100-yard wedge shot. I would never chase that green if it was on tucked front right, tucked front left, or back right, back left. I'm always going to be somewhere in that middle-ish area. Now, as I get closer to the hole, and I am a pretty good wedge player, I might adjust a little bit closer to the pin, but I'm never going to go all the way to the left or to the right, because on some shots, I'm going to leave the face a little bit open, or it's going to be a little bit closed. I'm going to miss to the right. I'm going to miss to the left. And more importantly, I'm going to miss front and long. So I'm always giving myself a little bit of cushion room with distance. I'm not going to chase a front pin and say, oh, it's 90 to the pin and 84 front. I'm not pulling a club at 87. I'm going to try and hit 9,500. Just to give myself some cushion so I can, if I don't hit it great or I hit it a little bit fat, I can still hit the green. And more important directionally, yeah, I still think the meat of the green is never a bad target. I always tell people I like you at the center and taking more club closer to the back yardage as a generic piece of advice. But yeah, as you get closer to the hole and your skill level increases, I think you can adjust a little bit closer to the pin, but never going like full. If the pin's in the middle, then sure, that's technically pin hunting. But I want you to stay away from those situations where you're going to short side yourself, because the data is quite clear on that. When a recreational golfer short sides themselves, when they have less room between them and the pin, they're in a bunker in the rough, their score is going to increase. So we absolutely want to hit more greens. And if we do miss greens, we want to give ourselves more straightforward chips or pitch shots so that we can get it on the putting surface and two putt for our bogey at worst. This is not hero time. This is where a lot of golfers throw away strokes in situations like these.
Mm. And that's a really interesting point, you know, using some intelligent restraint there. But when you said, you know, being more aggressive off the tee and more conservative on the approach, sort of that, I know we don't have 2 hours to get into it, but is that, would that be because, you know, the margin for error off the tee is, you know, taking hazards out of play is much wider, and where really anything on the green is going to improve your scoring like immediately.
Yes. Yeah. You get on the putting surface, that's a much better predictor of scoring. You know, you have a 60-foot putt versus a 30-foot chip. I'd take the putt every time for most golfers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the name of the game is hitting a lot of greens. And off the tee, it's more, can I advance the ball as far as I can while avoiding the big capital B trouble, out of bounds, penalty areas, fairway bunkers, trees, recovery situations. And I think a lot of golfers gave too much value, myself included, to thinking that safety clubs off the tee were the answer, and they're more accurate. They're not as accurate as they think with their 4-iron or 3-hybrid a lot of the time. So just by taking that shorter club, now we're giving ourselves a longer approach shot by 30, 40, 50 yards. And thanks to Mark Brody, who I know has been on the show and someone mm-hmm. I've learned a lot from, we now understand the value of that distance loss. So that's why, yeah, I had to embrace my driver years ago, because distance off the tee is a huge predictor of scoring. And more importantly, how often can we avoid that big trouble? But as you said, that could be a whole separate conversation.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And boy, is there nothing worse than pulling the safe club and dead yanking it. It's the worst feeling in golf.
It is. And I've topped. That's why I don't carry 3-wood anymore. I've topped my 3-wood as so many times I can't remember. But
right?
Yeah, say, I would say, If you can get a launch monitor and do a test with like hitting a 3-iron off the tee or your fairway wood and measure your left to right dispersion versus your driver and the distance loss, I think a lot of golfers will be shocked that that safety club is not as safe as they think.
I hear what you're saying. No doubt about it. So we did get a lot of questions from folks who were on this theme of what to do in the off season. A lot of our audience, probably half, is in the off season, or maybe more. What is your approach for? So Will asks us, as someone who might play once a month, but maybe not often for months, what drills or practice can be done at home to maintain feel and you know, the right way to warm up for golf after a long layoff? What can people do at home who are stuck away from golf?
Yeah, I think the easiest things to do if you're practicing into a net at home during the winter, like I do, I try to keep it simple and give a few different ideas in the book. If you listen to the podcast I do, you'll hear Adam Young and me always talk about our big three, which is impact, location, ground contact, and face control. The most fruitful piece of practice anyone can do when they're kind of, I hesitate to use the word stuck, but hitting into a net at home in your garage or wherever, spray the face with Dr. Scholl's Odorex dry shampoo. You've probably heard this method before, but just understanding, you know, our hands are great communicators to the rest of our body. There was this study done recently I came across where humans have this ability to sense through their hands, like a lot of insects do with their sensors. And I want you to understand impact is so important. You got to learn to strike the center of the face and let the golf club do what it's designed to do. And we can't do that until we understand what our tendencies are. So I think one of the best ways anyone can spend some time practicing is spraying the face, just feeling what a toe strike is, what a heel strike is. We know what a center strike feels like. See if there's a pattern there. For example, I'm a heel striker. And then experimenting, can I move this strike around the face? Obviously closer to the center of the face, but can I strike the toe? Can I strike the heel? And I think this is a great form of practice because it gets you outside of all of those swing thoughts. You know, if you're sitting around videoing your swing and looking at what your arms and hands are doing, most people don't know what to do with that information. I don't know what to do with that information. I'd rather you focus on a form of practice like that, that is, gets you self-organizing. You're trying to accomplish a task. It gets you a little more focused and has more intent on each swing. So that's like one bread and butter piece of practice I would advise to anyone, because in a net, if you're not having a launch monitor, you just can't see where the ball's going. So that's a very basic form of practice I would tell everyone to do.
So not spending the winter watching videos on YouTube?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, this is another topic I'm passionate about. And just to briefly like share my philosophy, I don't think golfers get better by increasing their knowledge on the golf swing. And I don't want to blame swing instructors. I think they put a lot of great content on YouTube and Instagram. The problem is that the algorithm is against us. So if you show an interest in the swing, you're going to be shown endless videos from endless instructors. And ultimately the issue becomes relevancy and continuity, is that you don't know what's relevant to your swing. And if you listen to a bunch of different voices on the golf swing, they're going to have conflicting philosophies. And then you just get stuck in this space where you're over the ball saying like, yeah, am I shallowing the club here? Am I going to, you know, am I doing a weak grip, strong grip? Like there's just so many ways to do it and so many matchups that I think that is a worse investment of your time rather than focusing on these like really basic, challenging practice methods that develop more skill without actually having to think about what your body's doing. That's the form of practice I prefer for most golfers. If you're getting lessons, great. Listen to that instructor, do their drills, listen to their technical information, and no one else's.
Good points. And the algorithm, yes. I mean, I'm so guilty of this. And it's funny how smart the algorithm is. The algorithm will actually identify even like the algorithm knows my swing faults because
yeah, sure it does, because you're searching for it.
I will save. I'll just see one. I'm like, oh, that guy or girl is an early extender, which is what I am. I sort of stand up a little bit at impact. My head comes up and my hips move forward. And I've been plagued by it for years. And now that I click on one, then I click on another, and it's like the algorithm knows my swing flaw. But I like the approach of, you know, where am I hitting, you know, where am I finding the, where is the ball finding the club face? You know, that's really at the end of the day, what matters. If the ball doesn't care where my hips are.
It doesn't get more basic than that. And sometimes right. Not just strike thing, you know, focusing on start direction or curvature and working backward to what's going at happening at impact. You can change the technique or what you're doing with the golf club without thinking about it. For example, I'm someone who struggled with a very excessive in to out swing path for years where my fault was a big hook. So the opposite of a slicer. How did I mitigate that? I just tried to do the opposite and hit fades for years. And ultimately what that did is it actually changed how I delivered the golf club, but I didn't watch any videos on how to get like less from the inside or any of that. I challenged myself to accomplish a task. And I always talk about being an athlete in golf is that my body figured it out, just like I would figure out if I'm shooting basketball. I'm not thinking about what my elbow is doing in my hands. I'm trying to solve a problem in an athletic way. And I want to get golfers more in that state when they practice versus, oh, I saw this on YouTube. I'm going to try this out for a while. And then the next week, I'm going to try something different. I think that just gives you a better chance. So you can solve these problems without actually thinking about what your body is doing. I just want golfers to know that that's possible.
And that's a good point. Be an athlete, right? That if, you know, I'm seeing this stuff on YouTube to sort of like, okay, this is how I'm going to fix this thing that my hips are doing. But if I'm actually focusing on, okay, what I really want is good contact. I want to hit the ground in the right place. I want to hit the middle of the club face. My body's probably making those changes without me. I'm probably not standing up at impact without me even having to like worry about it. Because when you're thinking just about like where, what my backside is doing, you can have some pretty awful results because you forget about, oh, the golf ball. I need to get there.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a number of ways to explain how to fix early extension, right? But you don't know which one is going to resonate with you.
Right.
Perhaps you'd have a better chance if you were working with an instructor one-on-one and they can communicate that to you. But if you are searching for that answer from multiple voices, it's kind of like chasing that needle in the haystack. You just don't know which one's going to solve it for you or resonate with you. So it's hard. Again, I don't want to say that there's examples of people getting better from YouTube. There is good information on there. I just try and speak in generics as best I can. I just think your chances of doing that are far lower, is my belief.
A question that I have, what role do you think, just because now that as I'm undertaking the index experiment, trying to get better this year, I've set certain goals. One of the things I'm doing in the off season is I'm working out. I'm on the Peloton. I'm doing stretching routines, all that stuff. I'm back to the routines that I used in Paper Tiger, which is pretty weird. There's actually pictures of myself in a binder from that age. I'm like, who is that dude? And I feel good. What about the role of fitness in this? And in terms of, you know, if you're trying to make a swing change or get better or have a better, more consistent, you know, ball striking, I'm finding that being a little bit stronger or at least having a little more stability in my core, I feel a little bit better over the golf ball. I feel like my chances are improving. What's your take on golf training?
I'm 100% in on it. And I think I've learned a lot from TPI, Titleist Performance Institute. I've learned a lot from a guy named Mike Carroll, who has a great app called Fit for Golf. He's a great follow on social media.
Absolutely.
I think there's a lot of myths. You know, golfers avoided weights for years. You want to, as best I has learned, is you want to match the demands of the activity. So what does golf ask of us? It asks us to be mobile and explosive and strong in order to complete this movement. So if you want to mitigate injuries and be more comfortable with your body and what it can do, we want to do mobility work, which is not just like static stretching. It's working on like your hip mobility and your shoulder mobility. We want to lift weights. We want to get stronger. And when you do lift weights, and I do it 3 times a week, your body will get more flexible. You will have more range of motion. Just doing a deadlift or a squat or a bench press or a shoulder press, you're putting your body through incredible range of motion under tension. I used to have some lower back issues a couple of years ago that have completely gone away. And I believe it's from deadlifts because I'm strengthening and stretching out that area so often. So I'm all in on fitness. And then the other element of it is the explosiveness. Is a lot of people are doing over speed training with something like super speed golf or the stack, where you're taking these weighted clubs and you're swinging as fast as you can and going through these protocols. And I've done it myself and it's increased my swing speed. So I would tell anyone that yes, it absolutely can benefit your game. You'll have more control over your body. You'll have less pain probably. You'll hit the ball farther. And it's good for your health. So I'm all in on it. But we want to make sure we're not doing something that's not relevant to golf. Like, for example, you mentioned Peloton. I have a Peloton and I like it. Riding the bike or running isn't going to make you a better golfer. Like, golf doesn't demand that of you. It's not a cardiovascular activity. Walking every day would help. But I think the best bang for your buck is lifting weights based on everything I've found out. That would be my, a lot of people shun it. And I think everyone should do some type of basic barbell routine 3 times a week. It doesn't need to be fancy. You're not doing things that look like the golf swing, bicep curls, shoulder presses, deadlifts, squats, bench press. That bread and butter stuff will check off a lot of boxes and help your golf game.
Well said. I still like my Peloton.
No, I love it too. I still ride it. I still ride it 2 or 3 times a week just because I want the cardiovascular benefit. But is it going to translate to golf? Like,
right.
There's more efficient things you could do with your time. But of course, we still want to be healthy and stuff like that. So I think it's a great idea. I do it myself.
Yeah. No, I'm on this sort of like, all right, I wanted to drop, you know, get down 10 pounds and then work in more strength and more core stuff and get down. So it's been good for the weight loss. I will, I'll give Peloton its due. And I'm learning all these new tunes. My music library is expanding fast.
Yeah. Peloton has great barbell routines. I did their strength stuff for over a year. They have awesome weightlifting stuff too. They have great content.
I've been doing their arms and chest stuff and it's been fun. I'm actually enjoying it, which is insane. A question here from Brian, asking about, and this relates to, you know, we're talking about, you know, what you're trying to achieve in the golf swing, in your own golf swing, owning your swing, swinging your swing. But when does a player, he's asking basically, when does a player get to the point where they can own their swing? You know, if someone's going out, he says, you know, shoot and can't break 120. Maybe there's not a lot to own there yet.
Well,
So where does someone get to the point where they're like, okay, I'm going to swing my swing. I'm going to work on X, Y, and Z. Or someone should still be in like, I'm still in finding a swing mode.
Yeah. So we did a 4-hour, 2-part episode on the notion of swing your swing on our podcast. So I have a lot of thoughts on this. I'll try and condense it.
Nice.
I don't use that phrase a lot. I don't find it particularly helpful, but I do like it in the same way because I'm biased that I don't have a cookie cutter golf swing. We did an experiment recently with Lou Stagner on Twitter where we posted a bunch of swings and asked people to guess their handicap. Yeah, and I knew everyone would be way off on mine. Not one person. I don't think anyone thought I was a plus handicap. And I guess the takeaway there is like aesthetics are, you know, not everything in the golf swing. It's, do you have functional matchups? Can you satisfy the impact questions of hitting the ball on the center of the face, controlling where the golf club is pointing at impact and interacting with the turf in a functional way. So the way I think about it is that, yes, I want you to have your own version of the golf swing that's comfortable to you. And I don't want you to fit into someone else's model swing if that doesn't work for you. But the best way I can explain it is the more beginner to intermediate players have more to gain than to lose through going through some type of swing change. And I would tell everyone, I'm a huge proponent of taking lessons. I think if you take lessons with an instructor you're comfortable with and their communication style matches yours quite well, and you commit to that instructor for a while, I can't guarantee you you're going to get better, but now you're getting customized advice. You're getting practice drills. You have a plan. And I would tell the golfer who's the beginner to intermediate player who is hitting the ball all over the place and has no clue what they're doing, yeah, get some lessons. I've gotten lessons. I haven't gotten one in the last 10 years, but I've had 4 or 5 different instructors ranging from when I was 11 through my early 20s, and they all helped me. I want you to get lessons, and I want you to hopefully work with an instructor who's going to work with your body and the type of swing you have. So that's like the swing your swing thing is like, I want you to create your own personal version of the golf swing that has functional outcomes on the course. It doesn't have to look a certain way, but it has to have functional matchups. I always use the word functional a lot. As you can see, I like that word in golf. But as we get better and better, we stand more to lose than we do to gain. So for example, at my level or your level, Tom, if I went through a swing overhaul right now, I'm not prepared to do that because, you know, there's some stuff in my swing that an instructor could look at and being like, hey, John, like, let's fix your takeaway. Like, you want to get to a +4 and start winning some big amateur events? You can't do this with this swing. We need to change some things. Well, now you're going to start tinkering around with a lot of trust and feels that I've built up for years. And now I'm going to have to change motor patterns. And that's going to take months. and there's no guarantee I'll get better, I have probably a bigger chance of losing it than I stand to gain it. Mm-hmm. So this is the hardest question to answer in golf, I believe. Pros go through this. They go through swing changes. Some of them get better. Some of them lose their tour card. So I think as you get better at this game, the more you stand to lose. But absolutely, for the question was the golfer is shooting 120, get some lessons. I think some of the practice methods I discuss in the book can help you. But if you want to make quick, efficient changes, like, yes, get help from someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, it's, absolutely. At 100, at that sort of range, north of, you know, shooting 100, just fundamentals are going to, you're going to drop quickly with a proper grip, stance, alignment, posture, all the classics are going to help you out. I would agree. Tell me more about functional matchups. I like the sound of those.
Well,
I want some.
There's an instructor named Shaheen Nakhchivani. He's become a good friend of mine. He gives like a trillion online lessons, and he's a great communicator on the golf swing. He kind of came out of nowhere. He's not PGA, but he's really brilliant at describing like what matchups work. Like, so for example, like, why does my very strong grip and closed face at the top of my swing allow me to hit like a functional draw? Like, that might not work out for some players, but it works out for me. So there's all these matchups between your grip, your wrist angles, the plane of your swing. I'm not a swing instructor. I kind of get some of it, but it's complicated. And that's why I don't like golfers to play amateur swing doctor, because as much as I know about the swing and as much intuitive knowledge I have, I still don't understand how all these matchups work. Because each golfer is unique in what their body can do. You always see, they talk about Jon Rahm and why is he able to generate so much power from that really short swing. It's just his body has a certain limitation on how much it can turn. And he's worked with TPI for years on how to accommodate that. Would you teach that matchup to other golfers? No way. That's Jon Rahm's swing. Versus someone like Scottie Scheffler and his footwork and the length of his swing. They're totally different, and they work for them because those matchups are in functional territory. So I love instructors who teach that way, who say, hey, I'm not going to make your swing look a certain way, but we're going to take what you're currently doing and maybe we'll make some grip adjustments. Maybe we'll make some adjustments to the angle of the club at the top of your swing and the downswing. Perhaps it's in your posture or alignment, but there's all these little tweaks you can make to perhaps get the club a little bit more closed at impact. It's this big puzzle, the golf swing. And it's hard to solve. You need a really trained eye to know what pieces you can take out and put in. And I just don't think recreational golfers are up to that task.
Now, when it comes to, you mentioned before, and I would agree with that for sure. You are a good wedge player. So we have a question here on the short game, the scoring game, if you will. What do you would love to hear from Benjamin? He'd love to hear some suggestions for practicing the short game.
Let me qualify my answer first. I'm really good at 30 to 80 yards. Greenside wedges, I would say that's the weakest part of my game. I still have some gains to be made there. And funny enough, you were playing behind me when we were in North Carolina, Tom, and I absolutely missed, I think it was the fifth hole. I was just dead to rights, short-sided, pin was like way above me.
Okay.
And I made the most, I hold it out, and the guys
hooting and hollering.
Wow. They're like, wow. What a great wedge player. I'm like, that's a broken clock situation, guys. That could have gone 40 feet past the hole. So I believe with wedge play, this is a part of the game where golf asks you a different question than your approach irons or your tee game, because now it's not a full swing. It's quote unquote feel. And feel is really, I think, being able to adjust your swing speed. So if I have a 50-yard wedge shot or a 30-yard wedge shot or an 80-yard wedge shot, I now have to adjust the length and speed of my swing to accommodate that distance. And how do you earn feel? I don't think it's something that can be taught. I think it's something you have to earn. And the way I like to practice feel is that I like block repetitive practice to settle on some type of wedge technique. You don't need six of them, but just one technique that you could step over the ball and being like, I feel pretty good that I'm going to strike this well on the face and not chunk or skull this. Like, I can get this on the putting surface, not to 5 feet, but I have this stock wedge feel that I can just use all the time. So I want people to figure that out, whether you get lessons or whether it's practice. Like, you need that basic technique, and it doesn't need to be complicated. Excuse me. And the other thing we need to do is we need to learn these distances. So I like testing yourself. Can you hit a 40-yard shot, a 60-yard shot, an 80-yard shot, and kind of store in your body what that feels like? And you could do that by hitting it to the same target over and over again for a while. I do this with my launch monitor. I think this is a great way to use the budget launch monitors. If we're talking about practicing at home, you can get the PRGR, one of the swing caddies, the Rapsodo. Like, there's a million of them now. They're very good at wedge distances. So start to learn what those distances feel like. And then to develop your feel more, you have to randomly test yourself. Try and hit it 37 yards, 65 yards, 50 yards. This is how I start every range session. I try and establish what 50 feels like, what 75 feels like, and then I vary it. And this has helped me with my distance control really well, because those were the shots I used to fear the most on the course when I had a 65 yarder.
Yeah.
Now I step up to it and I say, okay, I know what that feels like. I'm just going to retrieve that from my memory. So that's how I like to practice wedges, is this combination of learning a technique and the distances through repetition, and then testing yourself through randomness to kind of see if you can pass the test. I think that's a very simple way to practice your wedges.
I love that idea of, you know, getting a stock wedge feel that you feel comfortable with, so that, you know, wherever you might be, you have a go-to, you know, that you're not pushing yourself. Right. Like you said, you might not be holding it out, but you're not approaching that shot with that kind of fear that leads to the chunks in the blades.
The name of the game in wedge play, if you look at the proximity numbers for amateur golfers, you just want to get the ball on the putting surface to about 10 or 20 feet. Like, if you do that quite often, like, you've solved wedge play for the most part. You don't need to go on the course with the expectation that you need a flop shot, a bump and run, and use all these different clubs. I prefer keep it as simple as possible and keep asking yourself the question, can I get this ball on the putting surface? And if the answer is yes with that technique, stick with it. Don't get fancy. The fancier you get, the more you're going to introduce those big mistakes, which kill your scores.
And of course, all of this, talking about wedge play and practicing wedge play and learning your wedge distances, that requires one thing. You got to practice with your wedges.
You've
got to practice your wedges. You can't. And I am so guilty of this, of course, using my range sessions with a 5-7 iron and a driver, and feeling and neglecting the old 100-yard shot, because I feel like I can do that. I do that.
The easiest way, honestly, is to just make it. I think wedges are a great warm up to get your body ready.
Yeah,
the way I force myself to do it is it's just how I start every range session, whether I'm practicing or I'm going to play a round of golf. I'm trying to establish my feel for the day, and I think that's learning those intermediate wedge shots also can help, I think, benefit your full swing as well. So you don't have to overdose on them. You don't have to spend 80% of your practice time. But if you started every part of your range session, 10, 15% of your time with those intermediate wedges, like I do think you're going to see a lot of benefit in your game, because let's face it, a typical 15 handicap, when they miss a ton of par fours and par fives in regulation, they're going to have a lot of those shots on the golf course. So you need to be able to, again, get the ball on the green. That's the big question to answer, not to get fancy.
And as we move to the green, of course, that brings us to putting. And we have a question here from Eugene, who asks about aim point. Now, and I want to get your opinion. He asks, is aim point worth learning? Because we've had a pod with the creator of aim point, and a lot of people left that pretty excited. I know I did. Enthusiastic about what Aimpoint might offer. What's your take on Aimpoint?
I love it. I used to be someone who was totally. I always had good speed control, so I never three putted a lot. But I just, as good as I got, there was a long time where I just didn't make enough putts for my skill level, and now I kind of broke So this is an example of, I think I stood to gain from breaking things apart versus like sticking with what I got.
Right.
So I learned aim point. I got fitted for a new putter. I switched to a pencil grip. And now I think putting's a part of the game where your attitude matters a lot. And now I truly believe I'm a better putter, and I view it as one of the strengths of my game. But I don't think I have to credit aim point for helping me get a system on the greens, because I spent 2 hours learning it from an instructor named John Hobbins, who's one of their top guys in the Northeast. And that 2 hours, I would argue, was the most bang for my buck in terms of time invested and strokes gained in my whole like golf life. Hmm. I think Aimpoint gets a horrible reputation on TV. I'm not going to call out the announcers by name, but if you watch a certain broadcast on a certain channel, you'll hear an announcer talk about it like it's some voodoo magic, and he thinks it's crazy that all these top pros are using it. I think a lot of people don't understand it. I do my reads really quickly. I read greens faster than just about anyone I play with in tournaments. So I don't, there's this myth that it takes longer. I just think it simplifies the green reading process so much, and it essentially, what it allows me to do is remove, I'm all about removing variables in golf. I want to step up to the ball with as clear a head as possible. And when I remove the burden of wondering about what my read was, now I can focus on speed and depth perception and unlocking that athletic part of me, mm-hmm. rather than worrying like, do I have the right read? Like, was that going to break more of the left? And like, that's my last thought over the ball. Like, it's removed all of that. I do my read. I say, all right, that's a 1% slope, 2% slope. I'm done. And then I'm focused on just really absorbing the depth of or the length of the putt in my mind's eye, and then just trying to stroke it in that way. So it has totally simplified putting for me and giving me a lot more confidence on the greens. Would I say that I would do it for every single person who learns it? No, but I think it's one of the best, most simple ways to give people a way to accurately read greens, rather than all of the kind of nonsense that's out there. Like, oh, every putt on the course breaks this way, or there's just a lot of bad information on how to read greens out there. And I think it's backed by math and physics. So I can't say enough good things about it. Obviously it's really, really, really helped my game.
Outstanding. Well, this podcast is not endorsed or sponsored by Aimpoint.
No, I always have to be careful with Aimpoint because I don't want to share their secrets. Like, I wrote an article about them years ago and they kind of got on my case being like, hey, you're sharing too much here. So
right.
I have no affiliation with them. They didn't pay me anything. I'm happy if there's a good product out there to promote it. And I think that's a good product.
It is a good product. No, I was just saying, we've had two very, strong endorsements on the podcast now for Aimpoint. So if you're curious about Aimpoint, go back a few pods and you can learn even more from the founder. And it is very interesting, and maybe it's for you. But that's a whole other discussion of like, how did they monetize this thing? Like, how much do you talk about it, and how much is proprietary, and how much is just like, I feel slope in my feet. Like, how do you own that? Which was interesting, again, to talk to the creator about that. So yeah, check it out if that's of interest to you. What I think is really, you know, the overall sort of theme, I mean, there are a lot of, the overall theme of your book, The Four Foundations of Golf, I think gets to this point of like, how do we enjoy this game more? And a huge part of that is, and you know, and there's all beneath that, there are all these different ways to play better golf as a way to enjoy it more. But I think central to that is this idea of managing one's expectations. How do you do that? It's a big question, but for someone who's quite stubborn or struggles with that idea of managing expectations when you're going out to play, you haven't played in a while, or say, you know, we're going to be rolling into spring golf soon here in the Northeast, which is always a mixed bag in terms of your play, the playing conditions, etc. But I'm going to want to play great, and do I have to rewire my brain? Or again, how do I make some incremental changes on how to manage those expectations?
I think it's one of the topics in golf that I don't think if you get it right, you have very little chance of improving. So I believe it's like the fundamental of fundamentals, whatever you want to call it. Because this game is challenging and it tricks us into thinking we have to play a certain, I think we think better golf looks different than it actually does. And that's one of the things I'm always looking to clarify for golfers, because whether you're a 20 handicap looking to get down to a 15 or a 10 or a 10 to scratch, 5 to scratch, you know, you watch a scratch golfer play, it's quite boring. They don't do anything like that spectacular. It's more like they just don't shoot themselves in the foot that often. They're not like knocking down pins and draining putts. It's just very steady and boring. So to answer your question, there's a number of ways I try to help manage golfers' expectation, sharing stats, just showing what are reasonable outcomes, even for tour players with wedges in their hand, showing proximity data for approach shots for pros or even amateur golfers. If a 15 handicap hits it to 70 feet from the hole with an easy chip shot with a 7-iron, that's a good shot. You don't have to get angry about that. You hit it to 20 feet from 100 yards, you're on the putting surface, that's a good shot. So it's this kind of fundamental rewiring, as you said, of your brain into understanding like what does good golf look like? And more importantly, what are reasonable outcomes on the golf course for me and my skill level? And I can do that through sharing embarrassing stories about myself when I struggle with that. I can show you data from amateur golfers. I can explain to you that, you know, part of becoming a better golfer is being on the golf course. If you're someone who can only play once a month, I don't think that's enough time to learn and gather enough feedback from your rounds and get comfortable enough on the golf course to expect that you're going to have any major breakthroughs. So there's so many ways to solve this problem for different golfers. But I think the inherent issue is that, you know, we watched golf on TV. We're shown a version of golf that isn't exactly truthful. It's more of a highlight reel. And then we have all these golfers on the course. And I was like this for over a decade, just getting crazy and angry at ourselves for all these shots where I look at them now and I'm like, that was a good shot. And you're like losing your mind over it. And if you can make that fundamental shift, then the game really opens up for you. It has strategic implications. It has mental implications in your mood. You're more patient with yourself. So it does help solve a lot of issues. But fundamentally, you need to make the decision that I am playing this game for fun. It's not my job. And that no matter how good you get, I want to prioritize and ask myself the question at the end of the day, did I have fun? Because if I didn't have fun, then I need to think about my expectations must be out of whack at the moment and I need to reset them. And this is something that I do all the time. Technically, like golf is my job now. I don't play professionally for a living, but it's something that I have to do to like help other golfers get better. And I still ask myself this question every time I play a tournament or even a recreational round is like, did I have a good time? And if I didn't, like I said, why was that? And can I fix that for the next time? I am prioritizing fun over everything else. And when I answer that question, then it's easier for the scores to take care of themselves. Sorry, that was a really long answer, Tom.
It's a great answer. And it leads me to my final question for you, John. And we really appreciate your time. This idea of learning how to manage your expectations and prioritizing fun, it's bigger than a golf question. It's bigger than a golf idea.
It's a life question, for sure.
It's a life question. It can spill over into every area of our lives. Yep. How have you seen this, you know, working on this in your golf game, managing expectations, being realistic about what to expect for outcomes, you know, prioritizing fun, you know, how have you seen that affect other areas of your life?
It's funny, whenever I like tweet out these thoughts, I always inevitably get a response like, that's great life advice too. And my response to that is golf is life. You know, everything we face on the course, that's why I think this is such an amazing game. Like all of my flaws, I always felt the one thing that drew me to golf is like I was fighting all of my own personal flaws, my impatience, my temper, my obsession with numbers and wanting to like, that's what drew me to golf is like, this is a numbers game and I have a number attached to my performance every day. And that's why I got obsessed with it. But that's also what tortured me about it. So over the years, getting better at this stuff and reflecting on it, like I absolutely think it's made me a better father, like a better entrepreneur in my business. These are things that if we sort out on the golf course, they absolutely have positive spillover effects into life. And one of the closing thoughts I would give people to the index experiment is, you know, the hardest thing to do when you want to get better and lower your handicap is saying like, okay, I want to get to X handicap level. And I would tell people that if you have that number burned in your head all the time, when you're practicing, when you're playing, it's going to be much harder. So we have to like try not to try, so to speak. The best thing I can do, and what I try and give examples, tangible examples of this in the book, is if you have a goal, how can you then take that goal and adjust your habits and your expectations and your identity to solve that problem? Like, that's really what we're being asked to do. And if you focus too much on the number and not the habits and everything, so this is like the outcome process thing that we always hear in many walks of life and sports and business and personal life. If you focus too much on the outcome, then you almost trip over the other stuff, which is more important. So I'm trying to give people ideas on how they can deconstruct their game and look at it and say, okay, if I want to reach this ultimate goal, here's the list of four or five things that I need to do when I practice, or the types of targets I need to select on the course, or my mental frame, or the mental state I want to be in. You start focusing on those things, then the handicap will take care of itself. So it's this double-edged sword when we create this like numeric goal that we want to achieve. Sometimes it makes it almost harder to achieve that goal. So it's almost counterintuitive.
Great advice for all our index experiment folks out there. Absolutely. Get stuck in the process. The number will take care of itself. You know, hit better golf shots, do some simple things. A lot of the things in The Four Foundations of Golf by John Sherman, and the numbers will come down. John, thank you so much for your time. I think so as well. And we've certainly seen that come true for a lot of people. So, John, I love talking golf with you. It makes me want to play.
The next step is, you know, you and I are not geographically too far apart, and I am in your neck of the woods. I have my wife's family lives not too far from where you are, so we've got to do a home this year or something like that.
You're on, absolutely. Because you know, I feel like I'm going to play. I'm actually going off on a little bit of a golf trip, so I feel like I'm at a better place now in my mind. And I hope our listeners are as well. John, thanks so much. The Four Foundations of Golf. Everybody check it out. Check out the index experiment in your member locker on golfersjournal.com. And we'll see you next time on the Golfers Journal podcast.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And if you did, we hope you'll strongly consider becoming members of the Golfers Journal. Or if you're already a member, we hope you'll share it with your friends. As a reader-supported publication, we couldn't do it without your help. We also couldn't do it without the help of our sponsors, and they are Titleist, Scotty Cameron, FootJoy, Oakley, Link Soul, Links and Kings, Charles Schwab, and BMW. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Golfers Journal podcast.